2023 harvest. The government was keen to stress that essential water supplies for households are not at risk at the moment. Water Minister Steve Double said, "We are currently experiencing a second heat wave after what was the driest July on record for parts of the country. Action is already being taken by the government and other partners, including the Environment Agency, to manage the impact. All water companies have reassured us that essential supplies are still safe, and we have made it clear it is their duty to maintain those supplies." The group contains representatives from water companies, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, the Environment Agency, the National Farmers Union, NFU, Natural England, CCW, Ofwat, Water UK, and the Drinking Water Inspectorate, as well as the Angling Trust and the Rivers Trust. While previous dry summers have been offset by wet autumns, meaning the worst effects on water supply have not hit, those present at the meeting were told that was unlikely to be the case this year, with arid conditions predicted to continue due to climate breakdown. Slides from the Environmental Agency say an increased chance of warm conditions through August to October is consistent with an increased westerly flow from warmer than average seas and our warming climate, with a typical northwest wetter to southeast drier gradation in rainfall. Most likely, there are no strong signals for a significant amelioration of current dry conditions. Catherine Sefton, a hydrologist at the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, said, "In the southeast of England, the continued dry weather means that many river flows remain notably or exceptionally low, and hydrological forecasts suggest this situation will persist over the next few months. Where river flows are supported by groundwater that recharges during the winter months, the impact of dry weather is reduced, but a continuation of below average rainfall into a second winter would likely result in serious hydrological and environmental drought, with further intensification of the water supply restrictions and fish rescues that are starting to see in the southeast. The last time a drought was announced was in 2018. Though research has not yet been conducted to determine whether this year's drought was caused by climate breakdown, the dry conditions and extreme heat in 2018 were found by the Meteorological Office to have been made 30 times more likely by climate change. There have been 5 consecutive months of below average rainfall across all geographical regions in England and above average temperatures. River flows, groundwater levels and reservoir stocks are decreased during July. 13 Environmental Agency monitored indicator rivers are at the lowest levels ever recorded, and soil moisture deficit is comparable to that seen at the end of the 1976 drought. Scotland and Wales have similar drought reaction groups, which are also understood to be meeting this summer after drier than usual conditions.
Welcome back. The first part of the show went to Israel's Negev desert to reveal Dimona's hidden secrets. Dimona's core reactor is made of cement-coated metal. The fuel rods are inserted into the core where nuclear fusion takes place. Now, over the years, core absorbs tremendous amounts of heat and radiation, which slowly cause a degeneration of its materials. A Dimona core, which was put into action back in 1963, was intended to be operational for up to 40 years, but it's exceeded the intended time frame by over a decade now. In fact, Israel is least threatened by the Dimona, having its population living in the north far from the reactor. 95% of the wind direction in Palestine is northwesterly, away from the Israeli localities, but towards Jordan and Palestine. Mordechai Benunu, the Israeli nuclear scientist and whistleblower, has long stated in interviews that Dimona's chimneys do not operate unless the wind blows in the direction of Jordan, and that Jordan should test residents in areas just across the border from the Dimona to be sure they've not already been exposed to radiation.
Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. Arnon Milchan is a famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or LA Confidential. He was also good friends with Shimon Peres and Benjamin Netanyahu. Recently, he revealed his double life. During all these years, he worked as a Mossad agent, helping Israel to buy technology needed to make nuclear weapons. Under a Hollywood producer cover, he was actually a kind of godfather of Israel's nuclear program. But there is no story like that of Mordechai Vananus. Vananu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at the top secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vananu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordechai Vananu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. They sent a woman agent to seduce Mordechai Vananu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vananu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. The article was published on October the 5th, 1986. Vananu had vanished. His kidnap, an illegal act on foreign soil, was kept secret. Later, when Vananu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vananu M was hijacked in Rome. Vananu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vananu was Cheryl Bentorf. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vananu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordechai Vananu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, and they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Vanunu Mordechai.
Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away, a 20 meters high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vanunu took us inside. A heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help, with a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vanunu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. Adjacent to the reactor is Institute Number 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. Institute Number 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute Number 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute Number 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordechai Vanunu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it's conserved as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute Number 9 using laser, a unique Israeli patent. Institute Number 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute Number 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute Number 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground, are six additional floors. It was Vanunu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal, the manufacturing of atomic bombs. In the 60s, American inspectors visited the first floor. They saw the restaurants and the offices. A special wall was constructed, hiding the elevators leading to the underground levels. Back outside, trucks bring in the processed uranium rods. Through the large doors, a crane grasps the rods and lowers them to the big workspace four floors below. The rods are dipped in nitrous acid tanks, cooked for about 30 hours, and then a system of pipes draws the water containing the uranium and plutonium. Through a chemical process, the materials are separated and then baked in an oven, producing a small 130-gram plutonium ball, 1.7 kilograms a week, 4 kilograms, and it's a bomb. Just shot by Vanunu. The process can be viewed from level 2. A balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. And that's the control room as shot by Vanunu. Only 150 employees are authorized to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vanunu walked about Institute Number 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level number 4, Vanunu revealed the production of tritium used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vanunu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analyzed Vanunu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the sixth or even fifth nuclear power in the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to Queen Elizabeth International Airport, you know what?
From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. High cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. Tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Talifar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story, diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. Going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. Doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially, nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Bassem Saudi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbours? While we were filming with Bassem Saudi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. They also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. We are back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalil, very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumours. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumours in Berlin with Xanthe Hall.
200 cubic metres a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic metres of radioactive waste have been, as the bottom line, have been produced. And to try and imagine what that is, it's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic metres. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, and therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk, and that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on, or leukemia, and in particularly the children would be badly affected, because children and especially women are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found, definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the Second Intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. And by continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that it's perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, leaked documents predict crop failure rates of up to 50% as United Kingdom's water companies resist calls to prioritise food production. We are prepared for you an article written by Helena Horton. The piece is titled Mass Crop Failures Expected in England as Farmers Demand Hosepipe Bans. Experts have warned of widespread crop failures across England as charities and farmers criticise water companies for dithering over hosepipe bans despite drought being declared across much of the country. On Friday, 12th of August, Britain's Environment Agency classified 8 of the 14 areas of England as being in a drought. Despite this, water companies, including Anglian Water, Southern Water and South West Water, have not brought in hosepipe bans. Thames Water said it does not plan to expedite a hosepipe ban expected in the coming days. Leaked documents seen by The Guardian from a meeting of the National Drought Group show concerning figures about the state of farming in England. Half of the potato crop is expected to fail as it cannot be irrigated, and even crops that are usually drought-tolerant, such as maize, have been failing. The group was told irrigation options are diminishing with reservoirs being emptied fast and losses of 10 to 50% are expected for crops including carrots, onions, sugar beet, apples and hops. Milk production is also down nationally because of a lack of food for cows and wildfires are putting large areas of farmland at risk. Farmers are deciding whether to drill crops for next year, and there are concerns that many will decide not to, with dire consequences for the 2023 harvest. Cattle and other livestock are expected to be slaughtered early at lower weights, because it is likely that farmers will run out of feed for them in winter. One of the driest areas of England is East Anglia, which is also home to much of England's farming, including more than two-thirds of its sugar beet crop and a third of its potato crop. However, Anglian Water has ruled out a hosepipe ban for this summer, claiming that it has good levels of water in reservoirs. A spokesperson said, Today's declaration of drought across the region we supply serves to underline the seriousness of the situation. But because of the investments that we've made and the support of our customers, we still do not envisage needing a hosepipe ban in our region this summer. But farmers disagree. Tom Bradshaw, the deputy president of the National Farmers Union, NFU, said, "We have members who can't extract irrigation water, but still in East Anglia there is no hosepipe ban. We can't believe that we aren't allowed to irrigate to grow the fruit and vegetables the country needs, but there is no ban on excessive consumer use." He suggested the government should be intervening to make sure that water companies did not part to mitigate the drought, adding, "The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, or DEFRA, ministers need to prioritise food production. Feeding people is critically important." He noted, "The minister, Steve Double, was on the call recently and we made it clear to him that we need to plan on there being a dry winter and we need to fill our reservoirs or next year's food production could be in the balance. Irrigated vegetables are something a lot of people will be eating. If we don't have irrigation, there will be very low availability of vegetables." Stuart Singleton-White from the Angling Trust agreed, saying that chalk streams in East Anglia were facing perhaps irreversible damage due to the dry conditions. Stuart Singleton-White said, "It's still not being taken seriously. Take East Anglia, pretty much every chalk stream except the Stiffkey is at exceptionally low levels. They have had next to no rainfall at all and have some of the most agriculture in the country. So need more water for irrigation. Yet for some reason, Anglian Water has not put a hosepipe ban in place, and a drought being announced won't change that. We are in the position where areas classified as in the drought are not putting hosepipe bans in place." Stuart Singleton-White has called for a hosepipe ban across the whole drought-stricken region, adding, "There are still a number of water companies in the drought area who claim they have enough water and they don't need to bring in hosepipe bans, but that is just going to confuse customers." He said, "A hosepipe ban across the whole drought region would start to send the right message about us all playing our part to conserve water." The areas under drought measures are Devon and Cornwall, Solent and the South Downs, Kent and South London, Hertfordshire and North London, East Anglia, Thames, Lincolnshire and Northamptonshire, and the East Midlands. The Environment Agency expects a further two areas, that is Yorkshire and West Midlands, will move into drought later in August. The group met earlier this summer to discuss the lack of rainfall and decided to put the country in prolonged dry weather status, the first of four emergency dry weather stages and one step before drought. Now the country has been tipped into that second stage. This means water rationing may take place across the country with fewer barriers for water companies who wish to ban customers from using hosepipes and washing the car with tap water. More severe measures can also be put in place at this stage, including banning the use of sprinklers for cleaning the buildings, vehicles and windows. The group contains representatives from water companies, the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, or DEFRA, the Environment Agency, the National Farmers Union, NFU, Natural England, CCW, Ofwat, Water UK, and the Drinking Water Inspectorate, as well as Angling Trust and the Rivers Trust. Wild Previous dry summers have been offset by wet autumns, meaning the worst effects on water supply have not hit. Those present at the meeting were told that that was unlikely to be the case this year, with arid conditions predicted to continue due to climate breakdown. Slides from the Environment Agency say an increased chance of warm conditions through August to October is consistent with an increased westerly flow from warmer than average seas and our warming climate. With a typical northwest, wetter to southeast, drier gradation in rainfall, most likely, there are no strong signals for a significant amelioration of current dry conditions. Catherine Sefton, a hydrologist at the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology, said, in the southeast of England, the continued dry weather means that many river flows remain notably or exceptionally low, and hydrological forecasts suggest this situation will persist over the next few months. Catherine Sefton said, where river flows are supported by groundwater that recharges during the winter months, the impact of dry weather is reduced, but a continuation of below-average rainfall into a second winter would likely result in serious hydrological and environmental drought, with further intensification of water supply restrictions and fish rescues that we are starting to see in the southeast of England. The last time a drought was announced was in 2018, though research has not yet been conducted to determine whether this year's drought was caused by climate breakdown. The dry conditions and extreme heat in 2018 were found by the Meteorological Office to have been made 30 times more likely by climate change. There have been 5 consecutive months of below average rainfall across all geographic regions in England and above average temperatures. River flows, groundwater levels and reservoir stocks all decreased during July. 13 Environmental Agency monitored indicator rivers are at the lowest levels ever recorded, and soil moisture deficit is comparable to that seen at the end of the 1976 drought. Scotland and Wales have similar drought reaction groups, which are also understood to be meeting this summer after drier than usual conditions.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's revolution and Ashura. Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam awakened the conscience of the people. So you see, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Islamic uprisings were launched one after another. Of course, they were suppressed, but it is not important if a movement is suppressed by the enemy. It is surely bitter, but more bitter than that is when a society does not respond to the enemy. This is a great danger. With his uprising, Imam Hussein ibn Ali inspired individuals in all eras of the rule of tyrannies to fight against oppressive and corrupt establishments with a willpower stronger than those of the time of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, even though they lived farther from the early years of Islam, and they were all suppressed. from the case of the pricing of the people of Medina, known as Harra event, to the subsequent cases of Tawabin and Mukhtar uprisings, to the time of Umayyad and Bani Abbas, there were repeatedly uprisings within the nations. Who inspired these uprisings?
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If Imam Hussein had not risen up, would the spirit of laziness and irresponsibility change into the spirit of oppression, countering, and responsibility? Why do we say the spirit of responsibility had died? Because Imam Hussein went to Mecca from Medina, the center of the nobles of Islam, the son of Abbas, the son of Zubayr, the son of Omar, the son of early caliphs of Islam, all gathered in Medina. And no one of them was willing to help Imam Hussein in that bloody and historic uprising. So, before the launching of Imam Hussein's uprising, even the elites were not ready to take a step. But after the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, this spirit was aroused. This is a great lesson to be learned from the event of Ashura, along with other lessons. It is the lesson of Ashura which always live on as eternal and permanent debates not confined to a specific time. The lesson we learn from Ashura is the lesson of sacrifice and religiosity, the lesson of courage, justice, and the lesson of rising up for God's cause, and the lesson of love and compassion.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
During the year after Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, threats of violence or even death against lawmakers of both parties increased more than fourfold, says Andrea Mazzarino Ryder in an article published under the heading Armed to the Teeth, America has an anger problem. Stay tuned for more. Increasingly, it seems, Americans have an anger problem. All too many of Americans now have the urge to use name-calling, violent social media posts, threats, baseball bats, and guns to do what they once did with persuasion and voting. For example, during the year after Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, threats of violence or even death against lawmakers of both parties increased more than fourfold. And too often, the call to violence seems to come from the top. Recently, the defendants in cases involving extremist violence have claimed that an elected leader or pundit told them to do it. In a country where a sitting president would lunge at his own security detail in rage, we guess this isn't so surprising anymore. Emotion rules the American political scene, and so many now tend to shoot from the hip without even knowing why. Increasing number of Americans, however, respond to the growing extremity of the moment by avoiding the latest headlines and civic engagement, fearful that some trauma will befall them even by witnessing the news. As a psychotherapist who works with veterans and military families, an expert often speaks with folks who have decided to limit their news intake or have stopped following the news altogether. Repeated mass shootings in places ranging from schools to houses of worship, combined with increased visibility and influence of militias at theoretically peaceful demonstrations, can be more scaring than the wounds soldiers once sustained in combat zones. According to the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, 45 state legislatures in the U.S. have considered 230 bills that would criminalize the threat of violent leftist or black protest. And sadly enough, far-right activists are anything but a fringe minority movement as they challenge the very idea of peaceful elections and public protests that aren't theirs. To be sure, left-wing violence and combative rhetoric is a thing in this country, the United States, albeit a small one. The shooting of a Trump supporter by an Antifa protester in Portland, Oregon, during a Black Lives Matter demonstration in August 2020 is the lone example of a lethal attack by that left-wing group or other anti-fascists over the past 25 years. Of the 450 murders by political extremists during the last decade, approximately 4% of them were committed by left-wing groups and about 75% by right-wing, white supremacist, anti-government ones. So, what are Americans to do? As a start, given where the Trumpist movement and much of the Republican Party seems to be heading, Americans really need to do something, almost anything. As Michigan Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson, a Democrat, pointed out, facing the growing crisis on the right, I have seen no significant increase in support from national party leaders than what we experienced in 2018 when party vigilance was significant enough, but not nearly what was needed, unquote. A headline of an article in the satirical online newspaper The Onion caught the mood of the moment among progressives. Left-wing group to disorganize for FBI agents to infiltrate. In it, a fictional FBI agent says, "These people don't ever do anything violent. They don't ever do anything at all." Recently, a local Democratic candidate in Maryland knocked on doors seeking name and contact information as a possible volunteer for his campaign. It turned out, however, he wasn't even carrying a pen or paper. Ironically, one government institution that has at least made a nod toward countering right-wing violence is the U.S. military. Since the January 6 attacks, the Department of Defense under Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has acknowledged an increase in domestic extremist violence carried out by active duty or reserve service members. In response, he initiated a multi-pronged strategy to screen new recruits, educate military personnel about extremism, and begin investigating extremist activity within the ranks. As partisan rhetoric heats up in the United States, progressives are guilty of focusing too hard on the most politicized identity issues, however valuable or even whatever. Assigny behavior ignites behaviors and airwaves at a given moment, be it Trump's QAnon-style conspiracy mongering or ex-New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's groping. The problem is that as the Trumpists ramp up their anger, if progressives don't find a unifying message of community and love and find it soon, the guns already out there may be put to use in unspeakable ways. Progressives would do well to step back and think about the genuine big tent issues, like how to show everyone from white suburban women to rural farmers to black single parents that they have so much to lose in life if Americans don't have a government willing to continue regulating healthcare and doing so in a far better fashion. They would gain so much if, in this all too angry country of Americans, they could focus their attention on the importance of childcare for every family who needs it. Above all, if they could focus in an intense way on the ever more dangerous world they're living in, that would be a positive. Whether or not they agree on what's causing global warming, it's hard not to agree right now that they're living in an ever hotter, ever more drought-stricken, ever more extreme America. Why can't agree that it's already damn hot and the summer's just beginning?
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity, they have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. and I'm an artist. So it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel, and that's what we are doing here also, is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna.
In mid-August last year, the Taliban took control of Afghanistan and the Western-backed government collapsed. On its anniversary, the Afghan people have not forgotten what they went through during this period. Economic collapse, triggered by the U.S. seizure of nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets and cuts in global aid, has been one of their main struggles. Afghans lived through a harsh winter with little food. Based on a poll by Gallup Institute, nearly all Afghans rated their lives as poorly enough to be considered suffering. Meanwhile, some neighboring countries and international bodies rushed aid to the country.
We witnessed that after the Taliban takeover, people sold their children and body organs to put food on the table. I personally lost my job and have been unemployed for months. Millions of others were unable to make ends meet due to food and cash scarcity. I urge the U.S. and the international community to release frozen Afghan funds and let the flow of aid. Afghans can no longer bear the ongoing miseries.
The security situation in the meantime has been far better than in the past two decades. That's to say, people experienced less violence and conflict this year. However, the occasional attacks by the Daesh terrorist group continue to haunt the community.
Previously, our people were living with the U.S. bombardments on their territories. Under the pretext of the war against terror, the U.S. pushed terror in Afghanistan for 20 years and violated all rights of Afghans. Since the Taliban have come to power, our country has been more secure and peaceful. I hope the Taliban succeed in cracking down on Daesh terrorist group and tightening security for all.
The Taliban, on the other hand, failed to gain international recognition. Afghans and the global community have criticized the Taliban for not forming an all-inclusive government.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover. To date, the Taliban have been unable to form a government representing all walks of Afghan society and protect their rights. In Afghanistan's history, no government has been successful without securing national legitimacy and being inclusive. The Taliban should learn from the past, seek fair engagement with Afghans, and be flexible against the global community.
All things considered, international bodies and rights groups continue to engage with the de facto Taliban to advocate for the rights of Afghans and address their needs. They also have been calling on the Taliban to open girls' school as soon as possible. 1 year into the Taliban government, Afghans are calling on the international community to help the country's economy and force the U.S. to release its frozen assets. At the same time, they say the new government should engage more in diplomacy with other countries to improve the situation in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
As Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza and Al-Quds persist, another war continues to rage on in Europe. The battle pits pro-Palestine activists pushing a global anti-Israel boycott campaign versus local authorities who back ties with Israel. Founded in 2005, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a Palestinian-led movement promoting